Hey, everybody, this is a little Patreon-only bonus content. While our main feed, we are going to try and get out the common theme on opening arguments, right? Which is helping you navigate, particularly over Thanksgiving here, your conversations with Uncle Frank and Uncle Clarence at the dinner table. I thought, what about those of you, like me, for example, who have a mostly liberal Thanksgiving dinner table, right? What are there any sort of guidelines to engagement? Are there any thoughts I have on the Democratic primary and how we go about talking about that? And as you may have guessed, I have a lot of thoughts about that. The first thing I want to say is I'm doing this solo not because I don't want Thomas's opinion. I very, very much want Thomas's opinion on that. But obviously getting together this week right before the holidays, just scheduling the record for the show itself was a bit of a challenge. We're all trying to spend time with our families and prepare for Thanksgiving. So there just wasn't time to do this together. I don't know to what extent Thomas endorses anything that I say in this, and I think he's going to listen, and I can't wait to get his feedback, and maybe we will we'll do a follow up. Maybe we'll do that on SIO. Who knows, right? But obviously, there are some things I think we do have in common, but that's why I'm doing this solo. So, overarching principle, and again, if you have a liberal Thanksgiving table, then there's probably going to be agreement on this, right? And that is, hey, all of us want Donald Trump not to be reelected. And look, if you don't share that goal at the table, if you've got, you know, family members who don't share that, then this is probably not going to be for them. But I think it's worth sort of defining that up front, because that argument, I think, is, you know, while maybe also acrimonious, not a hard one to make, right? You know, particularly if you're like me and you have an awful lot of privilege coming into this, it seems like it is kind of the resting place of a lot of privilege to say, well, I don't care if Trump is reelected if we don't do X, right? Burn down the system, invigorate a viable third party, change campaign finance laws, abolish capitalism, right? Like, yeah, you insert it. I saw that argument in 2016. I have seen it. Hey, we won't be editing out the puppy here. I have seen that argument subsequently, and I don't fully know how to engage with it other than to say, you know, you clearly don't have trans friends who, you know, have been kicked out of the military or fear being kicked out of the military or have to plot a course of what states they can stop and go to the bathroom in while driving across the country. Or, you know, look, I don't have to make that case to you. I'm not going to make that case in this video. But look, like, I think it's worth, if you're having the conversation, we haven't named an Uncle Clarence here. The, you know, maybe we need a, you know, an Aunt Denise or something for your liberal Thanksgiving discussion here. I think it's worth saying, like, look, we all agree getting Trump out in 2020 is the most important thing, right? Now, assuming you have that agreement, let's talk about the background conditions for 2020. Right. I think there are really two important points here, and these are points that I have made at great length on this show, but they're worth emphasizing. So, number one, a deeply unpopular president like Trump can only win via the Electoral College. Right. And we know what that looks like. That looks like 2016. It means narrow wins in battleground states, even as he's being wiped out by 3+ million votes nationally. Right. Now, again, don't get distracted on this. Right. That you can say that means I hate the Electoral College and, you know, great. But the Electoral College is what we have in 2020. Right. So we need to talk about the fact that that will be Trump's strategy for reelection: narrow wins in battleground states. That leads to the second point, and you know what this is going to be. It's what we started the show doing, right? Which is, you don't know what the battleground states are. Nate Silver doesn't know what the battleground states are. Nobody knows what the battleground states are. That's episodes 1 through 4 of the show. And the takeaway is Al Gore did not know George W. Bush was going to steal reliably Democratic West Virginia in 2000. If he had, if he'd shorn that up, then none of the hanging chads, then none of the thin margin of victory in Florida would have mattered at all. West Virginia's 5 electoral votes would have made Al Gore president. That's part of why we started the show with that. In 2016, and I can't believe people forgot 2000. I really can't believe the people who have forgotten 2016, right? I like, people in my feed show up when I make political arguments and they say, well, you know, I live in a deep blue or a deep red state, so it doesn't matter. Wisconsin was a deep blue state until 2016, when all of a sudden it shows up as a Trump state. Donald Trump almost won Minnesota. Minnesota has long been considered one of the most liberal states in the country. Minnesota was the only state in 1984 to vote for the Democrat, Walter Mondale, right? That was Reagan's electoral landslide. He won 49 states. He lost Minnesota and the District of Columbia. And Donald Trump almost won Minnesota in 2016. He will be campaigning, well, he'll be running negative ads against the Democratic nominee in 2020 in Minnesota. I don't know what's going to be the next Wisconsin or Minnesota in 2020, and neither does anybody else. It probably won't be Alabama. It probably won't be California. But if anybody says to you, hey, my state doesn't matter, I want you to say Minnesota. I want you to say Wisconsin. You don't know. So I want to maximize the turnout for Trump's Democratic opponent in 2020. And here's how I think the best way to do that is. Obviously, the first point is the vote blue no matter who, right? I want to be clear here. That's not because Trump supporters aren't responsible for Trump's victory in 2016. I'm not looking to pin blame. This is, I get this weird argument from Jill Stein voters and, you know, and others who failed to vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And they say, well, you know, it's... I don't care about apportioning blame. What I care about is maximizing the turnout for whoever Donald Trump's opponent is in 2020 for the reasons that we just described. And I share much more of a common base with people on the far left than I do with people who are Trump supporters, right? You know, in the main feed, I'm trying to talk to Uncle Clarence. I'm working that side as well. But let's be honest, it's far easier for me to persuade the average OA listener, right, who is convinced that Donald Trump deserves to be impeached. It's easier for me to support and motivate and persuade you than it is for me to persuade Uncle Clarence. I'm working real hard on Uncle Clarence, but you're lower hanging fruit. And now you see where I'm going. The primary way in which I, pun not intended, in which I am trying to motivate you at this point, and this is the controversial thesis of this essay, is to minimize acrimony in the primary. Now, I have drawn a clear line on that. So here's what I mean by acrimony. By acrimony, I mean personal attacks that in the political science literature, this is called the sour grapes effect, right? People get disgusted with losing, and then they stay home, or they vote the other way, or they vote third party in the general election, right? Your primary candidate loses, and you say, well, the system's rigged, it's terrible, and by the way, the person who won is a corporate shill, is, you know, compromised, is terrible, whatever. So my implementation of that is, if you want to steel man the other side, what you might call tone policing. And the reason for that is because I have been very, very clear that I think you should robustly debate where the candidates are on the issues in 2020 and line up behind the candidate that best supports your position on the issues. I think it's really, really easy to describe the difference between those two, but let me do that. And again, let me not hide the ball here, right? All of you know that I am a Liz Warren supporter, right? So, for example, if your position is, gosh, I really want Medicare for All right away, I think the problem with Obamacare in the rollout was that it was staggered. And I'm really disappointed that Liz Warren is going to phase that in over 3 years. And I want to vote for Bernie because I want to send the message that the Democratic platform and Democrats should campaign on Medicare for All right away. That's a totally legitimate position to take. Not one I share, but that's a completely reasonable description of what the two candidates stand for and a reason, if you agree with that proposition, to prefer Bernie Sanders over Elizabeth Warren. And notice that if that content is debated in that way, right? What's the best method to implement Medicare for All? What's the best method that the likelihood that the ultimate policy that gets proposed by the Democrats in 21 is way closer to what I want in this hypothetical example than the alternative? I think, again, this hypothetical voter, that that's backing campaigning on Medicare for All right away. Great. But notice, if you do that, you're far more likely to endorse Warren if she's the general election nominee, because the difference between I'd like to phase in Medicare for All over 3 years and Donald Trump's I'd like to do nothing and roll back Obamacare is huge. Now compare that with, and I'm going to quote directly from an anonymous Sanders supporter who showed up in my Facebook feed. Some of you may know who this person is. And again, I'm not trying to attack this person. I'm trying to show what I think is harmful. Quote, people know that if Warren is telling the Democratic establishment she's a, quote, team player, it means she's on the team of the rich and powerful and is therefore not actually on the team of us regular everyday people. She has made her choice. People can't be fooled. It explains why she has been vague on many important issues and has flip-flopped, backpedaled so much, such as when it comes to Medicare for All and whether or not she would accept big donor money, bribes, as the nominee. Now, that is a word-for-word quotation. And again, this is the kind of rhetoric that I'm criticizing, and I'm going to explain why. I also want to sidebar and say, in my experience, this rhetoric is more likely to come from Sanders supporters. However, I'm not just targeting Bernie Sanders supporters, right? There are Warren supporters who are out there who repeat crap like Kamala Harris is a cop, or, you know, Pete Buttigieg is a Wells Fargo gay pride float, right? Like this is harmful. No matter who it comes from, even when it comes from people who support the same candidate that I do. So I'm not just saying it's all the fault of the Bernie bros. And I'm trying really hard, by the way, to live up to my own lesson here by not calling people Bernie bros unless it's, you know, like Thomas doing it affectionately of Jamie on SIO. So this is not just a Sanders problem. This is a problem in presidential primaries, and you see the difference, right? One is a discussion of a candidate's policy position. They're both talking about the same thing, right? Which is Elizabeth Warren rolling out her healthcare plan, which is a phased-in Medicare for All. One discusses the merits of that plan. The other denigrates Elizabeth Warren as a person, right? Flip-flopper, aligned with the rich and powerful, not on the team of us regular everyday people. So that leads me to the two premises that support my argument, right? Premise number one, personalized attacks are more likely to crystallize sour grapes and reduce eventual turnout for the Democratic nominee. Premise number two, small differences will make a big difference in the 2020 election, and it's unpredictable where. Right. I've already justified premise number two at great length. Not going to do that in this essay. I refer you back to episodes 1 through 4, and in fact, most of the rest of the show. If those two premises are true, then the conclusion that follows is that personal attacks are more likely to have a disproportionately negative effect in 2020, which is more likely to make a big difference. And therefore, if you share the overarching view that Trump is a monster and we need to get him out of office, the conclusion that follows is that you should avoid personal attacks from yourself and your circle of friends. And you should encourage the kind of discourse that I'm discussing here. So now, is there support for premise number one? I'm going to give you 4 arguments, but I want to be clear that there is not, as far as I can tell, in the political science or the psychology literature, a top-line conclusion that says personal attacks reduce turnout. So, all I can say is that I've looked through the poli-sci literature. I've looked through the psych literature. I could try and hurl elephants, right? Like there are. And in fact, I'm going to cite extensively to a Henderson et al. 2010 study. But I want to be fully honest, and I want to steel man the other side here. If you want to dispute premise number one, beginning with the idea that it is not firmly established that A causes B, that's what I view as the weakest part of the argument. Now, against that, I would give the following 4 counterarguments. Argument A, it's intuitive. There's not much to say on intuition other than I think we can all rely on our everyday experiences that when folks have criticized me for the content of specific arguments that I've made, I tend to take that way better than when people call me names. And that was the difference between those 2 things that we posted. And again, I want to say I think that this intuition is backed up by the statements of candidates who are opposed to the vote, you know, those who support candidates who in their support are opposed to the vote blue no matter who. I'm going to go back and quote our anonymous Sanders supporter in something that again just floored me. This person writes, "Every anti-Bernie Dem I've talked to has told me that they will vote for Bernie if he becomes the nominee. And that makes sense since they obviously don't have any moral opposition to Bernie. So let's understand that this makes it abundantly clear that Bernie is by far the most electable candidate for president. He has the best chance of beating Trump. Whether you like it or not, it is the simple reality that millions of Bernie supporters, and also those who don't label themselves Bernie supporters, will not show up at the polls to vote for any other Democrat in the general election. That's just the truth. It's not about my personal opinion. I'm just describing what would happen. Any other Democratic nominee would mean that 2020 would be just like 2016 when Hillary lost because she was perceived as yet another establishment, out of touch, wealthy, elitist, status quo Democrat who represents the interests of corporations, lobbyists, the military industrial complex, Wall Street, billionaires, multimillionaires, and her other wealthy establishment elite buddies / cronies. My response, maybe a little too snarky, was, vote for my candidate because I sure as hell won't vote for yours isn't a super great way of trying to persuade people. So, but look, the reason I quoted that is again, not to pick on this person, it is to point out the intuitive link. The more likely you are to use unacceptable personal attacks on the identity of another candidate, obviously, the more likely you are to, in this person's word, have a moral objection, end of quote, to that candidate if they get the nomination. Now, I'm flabbergasted that anybody could think that, you know, Elizabeth Warren, the person who single-handedly created the CFPB, whose signature central aspect of her platform is a wealth tax on multimillionaires and billionaires, could be in the pockets of billionaire overlords. But obviously people think that. Right. And the difference between having a debate over what the wealth tax means and saying, well, this doesn't go far enough and it doesn't socialize, like the difference between that and saying you're a corporatist shill who's against change is, I think, pretty obvious. Argument B, it is generally supported by persuasion studies that attacks on a politician's identity rather than her policies, crystallize opposition to that candidate. That is why it is ubiquitous in negative advertising. That, so I'm going to distinguish the literature supports that the idea in general from point C, which is, as a result, we see near unanimity that negative political advertisements on both sides of the aisle against opposing candidates uniformly rely on attacks on the person's character rather than attacks on the person's issues. And just think about this in recent memory, right? The attacks on Al Gore were, I invented the internet, right? Like that he was, you know, an out of touch wonk who kind of was padding his resume and was therefore not trustworthy. John Kerry, 2004, right? The windsurfing ad. He was a flip-flopper. He was an opportunist. He was the kind of politician who changes his votes. It didn't matter, you know, what his actual votes were. What matters was his underlying character. He was a flip-flopper. And then, of course, in 2016, you know, lock her up, the emails, like, all of that was designed, right? Had nothing to do. There was zero content to the criticism of Hillary Clinton. 100% was directed at her as a person. So now that leads us to the empirical question in terms of negative tactics. And I have a fourth argument, but I think it's important to get into the empirics right here as to whether they actually had an effect coming out of the primaries in 2016. In other words, did the way in which Bernie Sanders supporters went after Hillary Clinton in 2016 make an effect, a measurable effect, on the 2016 general election? And here, again, I want to steel man to the best of my ability. Write it. You're a Sanders supporter. Write in if you think I'm not doing as much justice to your argument as I can. I'm doing my best here. What I have seen is using a consistent methodology, the best estimates are that 12% of Sanders voters switched to Trump in 2016 and 16% of Clinton voters, Hillary Clinton primary voters in 2008, switched to John McCain. So don't blame us, right? Like, you know, it's not on, we're not any worse than any other candidates. And against that, I guess I'd like to say three or four things. The first is, again, this isn't about blame. This is about trying to squeeze every kind of marginal advantage that I can out of a particular election, right? Out of a particular electorate in an election in which I think those votes are likely to be crucial. And sidebar, it's possible that they won't be crucial, right? Like, it's possible that it will be a blue wave in 2020. And then look, like, that's great. But the strategy for Trump's reelection, which again, scarily and shockingly plausible at this point, depends upon suppressing voter turnout for the Democratic nominee. So I guess the first thing I would say is, don't aim, right? Aim higher, right? Like, if you're talking about the moral acceptability of candidates, don't aim for your guy and for your support to just be as good as every other candidate. Aim to be better, right? And aim to say, given the conditions that we're in right now, I'm willing to work harder than other candidates have done in the past. Because again, remember, it is 70,000 votes split across three states in 2016 that made the difference. And that, you know, look, like, that's the audience for the show, right? Like, it is, we can reach 70,000 people, and those conditions are going to prevail on the ground in 2020 if Trump's going to win re-election. Second point on the, hey, it's not our fault, is, again, you're right, and I would have, if I'd had this platform, criticized Clinton supporters in 2008 for the personalized attacks that some of them had, that the Pumas, right, which was party unity my ass, right? That's the Clinton 08 equivalent of the Bernie bro phenomenon, right? I 100% would have criticized that in 2008. I did, you know, but I didn't have this platform, so none of you know and none of you care. I have the platform now, so I think I'm being consistent. The other thing to note that is the major difference between 2008 and 2016 is that the 2008 election was not affected at the margins, right? So now pull out that pin for the Henderson et al. 2010 study. That was from Public Opinion Quarterly. Their top line conclusion is that the sour grape effect in 2008 cost Barack Obama 1.1% of the general election turnout in 2008. 1.1% didn't matter at all in 08, would have totally mattered in 2016, right? That would have swung at least the three states at the margins and potentially up to four others into Clinton's column. So it matters. It absolutely matters. Third point is there certainly are confounding factors at work here, right? And let me explain what those are. That is, racists pretended to like Hillary Clinton in 2008 because they didn't like the black candidate in Obama. And sexists pretended to like Bernie Sanders in 2016 because they didn't like the woman candidate. Here's at least some of the evidence for that. And again, I could work backwards from the Henderson study, but first I want to give you what I think is pretty intuitive circumstantial evidence, right? In 2008, in the primaries, Hillary Clinton won Oklahoma, Indiana, and West Virginia. She won West Virginia in May by 41 points. 67 to 26 over Obama. That may have been her single largest victory of the 08 primaries. I've looked at a lot. I can't say that I've looked at every single one, but 41 points is enormous, particularly in May, by which time, you know, the race, you can't say the race was decided, but the race was pretty directionally in Obama's favor, and this was a bit of you know, sort of a Clinton, you can't call it a firewall because she lost, but this was late and overwhelming support in West Virginia of all places, right? These are now deep red states. Want to take a wild guess as to who won Oklahoma, Indiana, and West Virginia in 2016? Yep, Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders won West Virginia by 15 points, 51 to 36. He won every single county in West Virginia. So look, you can go through and you can come up with alternative explanations, which is that somehow between 2008 and 2016, when Hillary Clinton was the overwhelming favorite of West Virginians, her track record as Secretary of State somehow caused 60% of the West Virginia electorate to turn strongly against her. Or you can take the far more parsimonious route. And by the way, that, you know, most of rural West Virginia coal miners are socialists. I suppose you could make that argument. Or people who vote Joe Manchin, right? Or you could take the far more parsimonious explanation, which is those states are voting for whoever is not the front runner, and that some of their reasons for voting for whoever is not the front runner had to do with the fact that in 2008, Democrats nominated an African-American. In 2016, Democrats nominated a woman. And the people who are most likely to be conservative in outlook are also most likely to harbor racist and sexist views. And by the way, that is, in fact, what the research shows. Go back to the Henderson et al. 2010 study, page 15. Of that 1.1% in 2008 that I said the Clinton sour grapes depressed Obama's eventual support, of that 1.1%, 1%, right, so almost all of it, is attributable to, quote, those more favorable towards whites than blacks, end of quote, i.e. racists. So go back to 2016. Bernie Sanders won primaries in North Dakota, in Kansas, in Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and Alaska. So again, you could interpret that as a groundswell of rural support for a socialist, or I think you could take the far more parsimonious explanation. Now, I do have one more piece of evidence, again, from Henderson that supports what I'm calling the more parsimonious theory, and that is, unlike 2016, in 2008, it was the weakest Clinton supporters who were marginally less likely to support Obama in the general election. In other words, and her strongest supporters were marginally more likely to support Obama. So in other words, more of the defections from Clinton to McCain came from weak Hillary Clinton supporters than from her strongest and longest backers. Again, it's not a huge effect, but it's there. That's page 16 of the data. You might hypothesize that the difference there that I haven't mentioned that would require an entirely different rabbit trail is the difference between John McCain, who was perceived as, and in some ways had evidence to support his run as a moderate Republican, as a maverick, as somebody who was not a traditional mainstream Republican, as opposed to the way in which Donald Trump ran, which, although Trump had unconventional positions, he certainly didn't run on anything other than, I guess, infrastructure, right? Which, you know, was, 0.01% of his campaign. I don't know that you need that argument, but I think it's also intuitive that it was, as somebody who went, you know, lived through and voted in both elections and spent time talking to, you know, moderate mainstream voters, it was far more it's far more plausible to think of somebody as supporting Hillary Clinton saying, you know what, like, I'm going to drift over to John McCain because he's closer to where I am ideologically than it is to imagine somebody supporting Bernie Sanders, the furthest left candidate in the primary, drifting, across a football field sized Overton window to support Donald Trump, who ran an almost entirely doctrinaire conservative campaign to the extent that he ever talked about issues, which again was almost never, right? And I guess I should also add that the protectionist stuff goes along with the infrastructure stuff, but it's a far less plausible path in my view. But even if you don't accept any of that, I mean, that's all just a sidebar. The important thing, I don't want to lose track of my own point, is that it was the weakest Clinton supporters who were the most likely to become the Pumas in 2008. And that tends to sort of disprove the notion that, it was that their opposition was crystallized early. Finally, the D point on avoiding these personal attacks is we have hard evidence that Russian-based efforts to interfere in our election use this tactic. And that's really the point of this essay that I was building towards. It is certain that Russia is already interfering in our primary. It is almost entirely certain that you, as a listener to this program and as a politically aware and involved Democrat, have probably encountered Russian bots and operatives utilizing this tactic to try and influence your vote. I know that's a big claim. To support that, I'm going to quote directly from Volume 2 of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on the 2016 election. This is what we know that Russia did in 2016 to meddle with our elections. And therefore, there's every reason to believe they're doing it again, right? Because Donald Trump has taken no steps to stop it, has actively encouraged it. Mitch McConnell has blocked every bill to try and prevent this kind of activity. So, you know, and it worked in 2016. So why wouldn't they do it again? Now, this comes from the Internet Research Agency, a St. Petersburg-based Russian-funded troll farm with a history of success in meddling in elections throughout the world. page 32. This is describing what the Internet Research Agency does. In practice, the IRA's influence operatives dedicated the balance of their effort to establishing the credibility of their online personas, such as by posting innocuous content designed to appeal to like-minded users. The innocuous content allowed IRA influence operatives to build character details for their fake personas, such as a conservative Southerner or a liberal activist, until the opportune moment arrived when the account was used to deliver tailored payload content designed to influence the targeted user. By this concept of operations, the volume and content of posts can obscure the actual objective behind the influence operation. Quote from an expert, if you're running a propaganda outfit, most of what you publish is factual, so you're taken seriously. Then you can slip in the wrong thing at exactly the right time. End of quote. Now, the lesson from that is, yeah, so somebody you've been following, right? You're a Warren supporter like me, and you follow a Warren supporter, and, you know, you're like, yeah, right on. And they've posted 90, 95, 99% of their stuff may just be innocuous, pro-Warren recitations, right? Things that other Warren supporters... That's designed to build up their credibility and have you put them on your safe list until the time in which they slip in the toxic propaganda. Now, how do they do that? I want to go to a couple of different places, right? Because I want to build from the top down, talk about it conceptually, how they do it, and then on a practical basis, how do they do that? So in 2016, and again, every reason to believe this is going to continue in 2020, the IRA maintains both right-leaning and left-leaning accounts. Their ideologically left-leaning and their right-leaning accounts post content that is political in nature. This is from pages 33 to 34 of the Senate report, and made references to the specific candidates for president in 2016. Hillary Clinton was the only candidate for president whose IRA posted content references were uniformly negative. Clinton's candidacy was targeted by both the IRA's left and right personas, and both ideological representations were focused on denigrating her. And again, I would add, because the language isn't explicit, but it's very, very clear from the context, personally, right? This is the support for my argument that you shouldn't be going after candidates personally. The political content of the IRA, and again, quoting the expert, was unified on both sides in negativity towards Secretary Clinton. The IRA's left-leaning accounts focused their efforts on denigrating Clinton, again, I'm adding this word, but it's clear, personally, and supporting the candidacy of either fellow Democrat candidate Bernie Sanders or Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And then this comes from the indictment that the Mueller investigation handed down of the Internet Research Agency. IRA employees were directed to focus on U.S. politics and, quote, use any opportunity to criticize Hillary and the rest, except Sanders and Trump, we support them. Another IRA employee was criticized internally for having, quote, a low number of posts dedicated to criticizing Hillary Clinton and was told, quote, it is imperative to intensify criticizing Hillary Clinton in future posts. Okay, so direct instructions. How does that work in practice? This detail is described on page 61. It involves a Tumblr account called For My Squad, which had wide reach. And again, the report says, IRA influence operatives use Tumblr accounts to build audiences of like-minded Americans. Here, this means very, very liberal. In this case, this was aimed at African Americans, right? Into which they would sow socially and politically divisive content. An IRA Tumblr account named For My Squad dealt almost exclusively with issues of sensitivity to the African-American community. On occasion, political content promoting Bernie Sanders or criticizing Hillary Clinton was posted to this account. For My Squad, and here's the example, posted a video of Clinton calling young black gang members super predators, which generated more than 50,000 engagements with authentic Tumblr users. Over time, the IRA's influence operatives took the messaging broadcast via the For My Squad Tumblr account further and began posting content promoting the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. So again, look at the tactic. It is attacking Clinton, not on the policy of the crime bill, which, by the way, passed, you know, when she was first lady and had nothing to do with it. And by the way, not on any kind of merits, right? Like it was calling Hillary Clinton a racist. I in an election against Donald Trump, I think that speaks for itself, in an effort to depress black turnout for Hillary Clinton by saying, yeah, well, you know, they're both racist. They're both unacceptable. They both suck. So I'm going to stay home. And we know empirically 70,000 votes made the difference. Look, I personally saw this in 2016. And those of you who have been with the show from the beginning, again, know who I'm talking about. Not going to call them out by name, but a prominent atheist socialist was reposting uncritically, without analysis, hate memes against Hillary Clinton from Fox News, from Breitbart, from other sources. So put all that together. Here are my takeaways. And this has been what I've been saying from the beginning, but hopefully you feel like it's backed up by evidence now. And if you think there's a weak point in my argument, feel free, send an email, openarguments@gmail.com. And they're real simple. Number one, do conflict on the issues in the primary. There are things with which I disagree with Elizabeth Warren. There are things with which I agree with the other candidates, right? Post those issues, discuss them with your friends, hash them out. That's what primaries are for. But don't do what the Russians are doing. Don't sow discord. Don't engage in personal attacks. If you find yourself using language like the kind that I've quoted in here, go back and ask yourself, like, look, if, you know, and again, let's think about it from our perspective, right? As an Elizabeth Warren supporter, I try hard. I've tried hard in this not to attack supporters of Bernie Sanders. I need to do better at that sometime, and I am trying. I try very, very hard not to attack any of the candidates personally. And part of that is Bernie Sanders might be our nominee. And if Bernie Sanders is our nominee, then by God, I will be donating to Bernie Sanders. I will be voting for Bernie Sanders. I will be volunteering for Bernie Sanders. I will be phone banking for Bernie Sanders, right? Like that, there is 100%, right? Vote blue no matter who doesn't mean vote blue no matter who, because my guy's likely to win, right? And the same thing is true. Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris. If any of those candidates win, I will be wholeheartedly, full-throatedly, unreservedly endorsing, volunteering, giving money to, and working for. We need to make sure that our rhetoric isn't accidentally setting up a situation where somebody is like, yeah, I'm just going to sit there. I'm so mad at how the DNC stole the election from X and gave it to Y that I'm going to stay home. We know that Russian operatives are hard at work encouraging you to feel that way. We know that this is a natural human tendency. It's not your fault, right? Like, that's why they're trying to manipulate you, right? Because it works, because people do feel that way. People do react that way. Let's not help our geostrategic enemies. Let's not help the people that elected Donald Trump in the first place. And with that, happy Thanksgiving, and may you have an issue-filled and not personal attack-filled left blue Thanksgiving table discussion. And I'll see all you guys soon. Take care. Bye-bye.